This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, January 5th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Auto Bogado. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is in serious condition following a brain hemorrhage, throwing the political futures of Israel and Palestine into chaos. Community activists in New Orleans physically block what they call illegal home demolitions in the Lower Ninth Ward. Talk of lawsuits and investigations in West Virginia as a local newspaper reveals that the Sago coal mine had 200 safety violations filed against it last year. These stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that terror suspect Jose Padilla can be transferred to civilian custody. But that ruling will not mean his legal challenge to the president's indefinite detention powers will be thrown out. From WMNF in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer reports.
Padilla, an American citizen, was held for over 3 years without charge on suspicion of planning to explode a radioactive dirty bomb, but was recently indicted on unrelated charges. The Bush administration had been advancing an argument that if Padilla is transferred from military custody, his pending Supreme Court challenge to Bush's powers to detain American citizens without charge should be thrown out. While the Supreme Court justices overruled last month's appeals court denial of the transfer to civilian custody, they said they will consider whether to hear the challenge to Bush's indefinite detentions at a later time. That case is set for review at a private meeting of the justices on January 13th. Padilla now will be brought from a military brig in South Carolina to law enforcement authorities in Miami, where he will face charges that he conspired with Al-Qaeda to commit terrorist attacks overseas. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The South Asia Free Trade Agreement, or SAFTA, came into effect this week, lifting trade restrictions among the 7 member South Asian nations. From New Delhi, Vinod Kejoz reports.
The area, including India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Maldives, Nepal, and Bhutan, turned into a free trade zone on the first day of 2006. Nearly 23% of world's population, that is 1.5 billion, lives in the South Asian region, which is just 3% of the world's area. The Free Trade Pact is considered to be by far the most important decision taken by the 7-nation member South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, or SAARC, during its 20-year existence. A South Asian Free Trade Zone was first proposed 2 decades ago, but the initiative moved slowly because less developed countries feared they would lose too much revenue from lower customs duties. Proponents of the South Asian Free Trade Area Agreement say the treaty will boost international commerce and trade in one of the world's poorest regions. Opponents are apprehensive, saying the agreement could negatively affect small-scale local industries, agriculture, and fishing. From New Delhi in India, I'm Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Cereal manufacturer Kellogg has announced that it will begin using an oil derived from Monsanto genetically modified soybeans in a number of its products beginning this year. Although U.S. food manufacturers are typically low-key about their use of GM food in their products, Kellogg is touting the new GM soy-based oil, Vistiv, as a low-fat alternative to partially hydrogenated soybean oil. The Food and Drug Administration began to require the labeling of food products containing trans fats on January 1st. The FDA does not require labeling for genetically modified ingredients. Kellogg brands include Cheez-It, Pop-Tarts, Nutri-Grain, and Morningstar Farms. A panel of judges appointed by the World Trade Organization has once again delayed a preliminary decision on genetically modified crops. Naomi Fowler has more from London.
Many European Union countries have been refusing to accept genetically modified crop imports for years. The issue has been the subject of an intense battle of wills between the European Union and GMO-producing United States, Canada and Argentina. Millions of dollars in trade are at stake. The United States has long labelled European Union objections to and restrictions on genetically modified food imports as protectionism. They claim the restrictions violate World Trade Organization rules. But EU objections are based on evidence they say shows Europeans don't want GM food. GM food is labelled in some EU countries, unlike in the US, and surveys seem to show that European consumers reject GM foods at levels of around 70%. Deadlines on a final ruling have been extended ever since the World Trade Organization panel of judges was set up in 2004. The final ruling will now be in March. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Office of the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, has issued a report blasting the department's negligence to properly oversee field trials of experimental genetically engineered crops. The recently released audit report found that the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, has failed to comply with the agency's own operational procedures and even a federal law passed in 2000. APHIS is the agency that oversees biotechnology regulatory functions for the Department of Agriculture. The stinging 75-page document details cases of official negligence and lack of oversight, particularly with respect to monitoring experimental test fields used to grow plants engineered to produce industrial ingredients or pharmaceuticals. The Office of the Inspector General found that APHIS failed to exercise proper control over these test sites, did not conduct the inspections that it publicly stated it would perform, and in some cases, did not even know the locations of experimental fields. The audit report concluded that the agency's current regulations, procedures, and policies, quote, do not go far enough to ensure the safe introduction of agricultural biotechnology. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is hanging between life and death today following a massive brain hemorrhage Wednesday night. Doctors say 2 out of 3 patients with his condition die, and most of those who live are severely disabled. Until his stroke, Sharon's new Kadima party was expected to finish first in a general election set for March, but now that party's future and its policy agenda is uncertain. Sharon's reputation as a hawk made it possible for him to forcibly remove some Israeli settlers in occupied Palestine. He's been involved in every Israeli war since the country's founding. Among other things, he directed the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, and he was found responsible for a massacre of Palestinians in 2 refugee camps. Over the course of the last year, he pushed a policy of unilateral disengagement, pulling Israeli settlers out of some far-flung areas while consolidating Israel's grip on other settlements in Palestine that are also illegal under international law. While Sharon's life may be saved, the seriousness of his condition makes his exit from Israeli politics all but certain. That throws into play not just the future of his new political party, but Israel's entire policy toward Palestine. Joining us to discuss the situation is Chris Tenzing, editor of the Middle East Report. Chris Tenzing, what does this do to the new center-right party, Kadima? Can it stand on its own 2 feet without Sharon? What does this do to the new party, Kadima, that Sharon founded? Can it stand on its own 2 feet yet?
That's an open question. The party, as of yesterday, was not so new that it had not even formed the rankings for its list going into the March elections, meaning that there was no designated heir to Prime Minister Sharon in the event of his incapacitation or his death. So they are, they have been in conference today to try to take the first steps toward setting themselves up in that way. They have made public statements indicating that they intend to stay together as a party and that they intend to campaign on the same platform that Sharon would have. The party, however, was formed by Sharon. It was largely brought together and held together by the force of Sharon's personality. One person who might leave is Shimon Peres, formerly of the Labor Party, who has said publicly when he left the Labor Party to join Kadima that the only reason he was joining is because he thought that Sharon could forward the peace process. He specifically said that he didn't think the party without Sharon or any of the other figures in the party could do so. So he may be one person who leaves. But a big question will be whether the many politicians who left the Likud party to join Kadima will stick with Kadima, or will some of them go back to the Likud now that Sharon appears to be out, at least, of the political picture.
Sharon built the party partly around his policy of unilateral disengagement in the occupied territories, that is, abandoning some settlements and consolidating Israel's grip on others. What do you think the future is of that policy?
That policy is certainly the touchstone and centerpiece of the Kadima platform. They don't really have a socioeconomic platform that they're all united on. So if they are going to campaign vigorously, it will be around that set of ideas. Now, the question is, I think that set of ideas has an innate appeal to the sort of broad center of Israeli voters, security-conscious voters who believed after the outbreak of the Second Intifada that there was no negotiating with the Palestinians ever until the end of time. So people are still, I think, sympathetic to that basic point of view. The problem for Kadima is that many people thought that only a figure with Sharon's charisma and his history of having been on the Israeli right, the sort of Nixon going to China phenomenon, that only Sharon could actually implement the program without causing fatal tears in the fabric of the Israeli nation. And so the question will be whether any other politician in Kadima has the charisma and personal abilities to convince Israelis that they also can pull it off. And the answer is probably not. Probably a lot of voters will either go back to the Likud or look around for other options.
Well, tell me what those other options are. What alternatives are there to this policy if it does fall apart?
Well, the two sort of ready-made options would either be a return to greater Israel ideology as embodied in the Likud leader, Netanyahu, who I think is so far emerging as the likely beneficiary of Sharon's passing from the political scene. And then the other major candidate would be Amir Peretz, the new head of the Labor Party, who has certainly caused a lot of buzz, both because he has returned to the more dovish-sounding rhetoric of the 1990s of the Labor Party, and also because, unlike all of the older generation of Labor Party politicians, he is not of European Jewish extraction. He's of Middle Eastern Jewish extraction. And he speaks directly because he comes from work of the Sephardi Jewish working class in Israel, which has normally been a pretty solid electoral base for Likud, but could respond to Peretz's social democratic rhetoric about bringing the Labor Party back to its socialist roots, and could vote for him in some numbers. So we could have an interesting three-way race developing between whoever Kadima selects as the heir to Sharon, probably Ehud Olmert, the deputy prime minister, Netanyahu on the right, and then Peretz on the left.
Chris Tenzing, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Today was the bloodiest day in Iraq since elections. Two massive suicide bombings killed at least 130 people, and five U.S. soldiers died in a roadside bombing. Last night, President Bush pressed his message that the United States is making progress in the fight against terrorism. He spoke about plans and prospects for reducing U.S. troop levels in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Anastasia Genestitska reports from the nation's capital.
In today's speech, President Bush has announced a possible net decline of several thousand troops below the pre-election baseline of 138,000 in Iraq, with further adjustments possible, and a reduction in Afghanistan from 19,000 to 16,500. He cited an increasing NATO role in Afghanistan and the continued training of Iraqi forces and democratic process in both countries.
And during these elections, the Iraqi troops showed our commanders on the ground and showed the American people that they're becoming more and more capable of performing their duty to provide security to the Iraqi people. Now, you got to understand that just because the elections went forward, that doesn't mean these Zarqawi types are going to lay down their arms. They're not. There'll still be violence. So in 2006, the mission is to continue to hand over more and more territory and more and more responsibility to Iraqi forces.
Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, gives her assessment to these plans and statements.
They're under enormous political pressure to avoid further U.S. casualties and to avoid the constant headlines of U.S. troops failing to bring stability to Iraq. That, however, does not mean that they intend to end the occupation. The level of troop commitment that now is in Iraq, about 150,000, which soon will be down to the what they call the normal rate of about 135,000, is way more than they want as a permanent deployment in Iraq. I think that what they want is somewhere in the area of 40,000 to 50,000 troops permanently deployed in the 14 permanent bases.
A sign of change in administration's rhetoric, prompted by public and political discontent with the war, has been today's meeting with former secretaries of defense and state, who have disagreed with Bush's approach to war in Iraq. President promised to take to heart suggestions on Iraq by William Perry, Madeleine Albright, and others. The president's speech coincided with the major attacks in which two suicide bombers killed 120 people and wounded more than 200 in the cities of Karbala and Ramadi, making these days the bloodiest that Iraq witnessed for 4 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
Representative Edward J. Markey held an emergency town meeting last night to discuss the Bush administration's authorization of domestic spying. This was the first public meeting of its kind to frame the issue in terms of constitutional rights. Chuck Rosina files this report from Boston.
The location of this meeting is on Paul Revere's route, and Representative Markey made several references to a modern-day sounding of the alarm that our freedom is under attack. Using recent quotes from President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Attorney General Gonzales, including right up to January 4th, the same day this meeting took place, Representative Markey analyzed and discussed how these actions eroded our civil liberties. President Bush has authorized spying on American citizens as part of his war on terror without obtaining court approval at any time. Representative Markey was joined by panelists Carol Rose, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union, and Mark Rotsberg, Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Representative Markey framed the debate in terms of our right to privacy.
It is, without question, a serious threat to the privacy of all Americans if the government believes that it has an inherent authority, regardless of any laws on the books, to be able to go to telephone companies, internet companies, cell phone companies, and just find out everything that you're doing. And we're not talking about foreigners here. This whole debate is about American citizens.
Representative Markey and his staff had organized the evening into what they called 8 myths that President Bush operates under. For example, myth number 5 stated that the National Security Agency program was not hidden from congressional oversight. President Bush claims that members of Congress are periodically briefed. Markey pointed out that he is the senior Democrat on the Homeland Security Committee east of the Mississippi, yet he has never been briefed. Carol Rose of the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union responded to this myth.
I think we need a special prosecutor with subpoena powers who's going to be able to look and see in this area and in others what the president's doing. And the only other point I would make, which is it's a fundamental attack on the system of checks and balances, and that's what we need to do is to restore our system of checks and balances. The government is increasing its power to watch you and diminishing your power to watch the government, and that is extraordinarily dangerous.
Myth number 7 stated that the FISA court places undue restrictions in fighting the war on terror. Mark Rottenberg of the Electronic Privacy Information Center responded.
What they're basically saying is they're upset that they can't do data mining, warrantless data mining.
Right.
That's what they're saying, right? I mean, isn't that it? They're saying we have this tremendous surveillance capability. It's called the National Security Agency. We want to get everything we possibly can and sort it out later. And they're frustrated they can't do that because of something, I guess, called the Fourth Amendment. Well, you know, welcome to America. We have a constitution.
Representative Markey noted that this whole thing unfolded less than 3 weeks ago, and with the holidays in between, he was impressed with both the work that his staff had done and the turnout to this town meeting. The auditorium at the museum at our National Heritage was filled to capacity. During the question period, Representative Markey was asked about the president's pledge to uphold the Constitution. He responded,
I think that there is a strong libertarian strain which runs through the Republican Party that is going to join up with the very strong civil liberties strain that runs through the Democratic Party. So I think that the president is going to be on the run from the day that we get back to Washington. And I think that...
There were also questions on how to move forward, including blocking the nomination of Judge Sam Alito and filing articles of impeachment. Through a show of hands, it was clear that President Bush had no supporters for his domestic surveillance in this crowd. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina, reporting from Lexington, Massachusetts.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can log on to www.fsrn.org. In New Orleans, roughly 100 organizers and residents of the Lower Ninth Ward physically blocked bulldozers to stop the demolition of damaged homes there. There's a court injunction in effect barring such demolitions until a judge rules on whether it's legal for the city to destroy homes without notifying their owners. This morning, Curtis Muhammad of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund confronted a heavy equipment team.
Hey, only okay. Because you're in our work zone.
Okay. All right, we'll move out of the work zone. Get that other one stopped.
We can talk reasonably outside of the work zone.
Well, let's pause the machines.
We will
move the people. Just get your dozer stopped. Ain't no danger as long as they stop.
A crowd showed up shortly after, effectively ending demolition for the rest of the day. A class action suit against the planned demolitions has moved from the state to federal courts due to its constitutional ramifications. Citizens are demanding the right to be notified about the demolition and removal of their property. They say they have the right to decide whether their possessions are debris or not, and they say they fear that bodies of loved ones are still in the debris that may be hauled away. This is the voice of Ishmael Muhammad at the demolition site.
We're in a neighborhood here that has been severely wrecked. They have already cleared several streets in the neighborhood. And in clearing those streets, they have cleared bodies, they have cleared homes, and they have disregarded and treated this community in an inhumane way.
A hearing on the status of the legal case will take place in New Orleans City Council chambers at 10 a.m. tomorrow. A federal court is expected to issue a decision on the class action suit tomorrow as well. FSRN reporter Christian Roseland recorded the audio for this story. Randall McCloy, the only survivor of Monday's explosion at the Sago coal mine in West Virginia, is in critical condition after 42 hours trapped in the mine. Meanwhile, the Charleston Gazette is reporting the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration filed 200 safety violations against the mine in the past year. Families of the 12 victims are discussing lawsuits against the company, and elected officials are demanding answers about whether the blast could have been prevented. From Washington, D.C., Ingrid Drake reports.
The White House and Republican Congress members have denied Democrats' call for immediate congressional hearings into the Sago tragedy, asking instead to wait for the U.S. Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration to conduct its investigation. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan.
In terms of the federal government, the Secretary of Labor earlier today announced that they will fully investigate this tragedy that occurred in West Virginia, and they will take steps to prevent something like this from happening again when they complete that investigation and learn more about what caused this to happen.
How public these investigations will be is not clear, says Ellen Smith, editor of Mine Safety and Health News.
MSHA has an excellent forensic team that can go in and reconstruct an accident scene. What I don't have faith in is the fact that it's so difficult anymore to get records from MSHA, and I mean factual records that are not opinion. When there were accidents in the past, we could get minor witness interviews, we could get citations issued to the mine, we could get dust sample violations, things like that. MSHA is no longer making that material available to the press or the public.
Several times during the last 6 months, sections of the roof at the Sago mine have collapsed. It is unclear how this and 101 other safety violations classified as significant and substantial were addressed by the mine's owner. Smith says that while the industry has made great improvements in safety, there is much more to do.
If you follow the regulations and you follow your mining plans, including your ventilation and roof control plans, you just don't have these accidents.
The Sago mine, which operates 24 hours a day, is owned by the International Coal Group. The Kentucky-based company operates 11 mining complexes in Illinois, Maryland, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and boasts on its website that its mines are, quote, union-free. While the International Coal Group contributed $2 million to the Sago Mine Fund to provide financial support to the families, some of the families say they are considering legal action. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Today, women across the planet are launching a campaign to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq. The Women Say No to War campaign aims to gather 100,000 signatures of support by International Women's Day on March 8th. They'll deliver the signatures to politicians in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. Leilani Albano reports.
Female legislators, activists, authors, and actors are among those taking part in an international effort to end the Iraq War. Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee, mother of deceased soldier Cindy Sheehan, authors Maxine Hong Kingston and Alice Walker, and actress Margaret Cho are among those expected to participate. Initiated by the social justice group Code Pink, the goal of the campaign is to gather 100,000 signatures from women from all parts of the world to demand an end to the U.S. invasion in the region. Jody Evans is a co-founder of Code Pink.
We've been collecting endorsers, women from around the world who eagerly have joined us. Enough. We've had enough. We need to get out of Iraq.
Organizers say the situation in Iraq has grown dire. According to Code Pink statistics, 100,000 Iraqis, 2,182 U.S. troops, 98 U.K. soldiers, and hundreds of humanitarian aid workers have died as a result of the occupation. Of all of the victims, women have been especially devastated by the violence.
Women have been really the first victims of this war and ongoing occupation of Iraq.
Hussan Mahmoud is a campaign participant and spokeswoman for the group Equality for Women in Iraq.
It's a really, really difficult situation is being created, particularly for women in Iraq due to the occupation. They were the first victims to lose almost all their basic rights, and that they found themselves being attacked, kidnapped, raped, sold to the neighboring countries for prostitution, and actually they cannot even go out.
Jody Evans says that women in the U.S. are also being victimized by the war effort.
We're suffering not only the mothers like Cindy Sheehan who've lost their children. There are the thousands of mothers whose children have come back maimed and wounded. And then we have those of us who suffer because of our education needs being cut, our health needs being cut.
Instead of war, the campaign promotes a conflict resolution model, calling for the full withdrawal of troops, full representation of women in the peace process, and gender equality following the withdrawal.
We call on all the people across the world to actually support progressive, secular, left forces inside Iraq, the women's organizations, unions, and other left organizations in Iraqi society, because they're the only hope, really, in Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
FSRN is a worker-run collective. Simba Rousseau and Monica Lopez produce our newscast. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Patchett-Seekins and Eric Klein. For archives of this or any other newscast, please visit our website, www.fsrn.org. www.fsrn.org. In Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.